Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And boy, are we excited for the show tonight. The show has been kind of a long time in the coming, but with all the hurricanes and the traveling and all the craziness in the world, we had to put it off for a few weeks. But we're here. We're ready to go. So without any further ado, Dennis, why don't you take the huge privilege to introduce tonight's guest?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Up there in the frozen ozone, Americans fought for their lives in ways and under circumstances unimaginable, with buddies, pieces of planes, and pieces of friends spiraling down. All around them, they droned on, steady on course for their intended targets in France, Germany, Romania, Italy, Japan, and all places in between. The casualty rates were horrendous, and the ways to die as varied as one's imagination, but almost all were not quick. Some, spiraling down, prisoners to centrifugal force, were pinned to walls staring into the terrified eyes of friends, all aware their short lives had now come down to seconds. They could only wait for the quick dark. One of these men who braved the frozen ozone was Captain Arthur Allen, who, fortunately for us, candidly wrote of his experiences in 1943. He wrote something he called Ramblings of a Bomber Pilot, and I'd like to read an excerpt of that to you right now. We haven't been in England long, about 6 weeks, and in that time we've been on 7 raids over German-owned and occupied land. And it isn't at all what we expected. Back in the States, we read newspaper stories of flying fortresses making raids, and always at the bottom was the phrase, none of our bombers were lost. Of course, we had read of B-17s being all shot up and coming home on 2 engines, but we really thought these were isolated cases. We didn't have the slightest idea of the nature of this theater of operations. We never dreamed that after 6 weeks of operations, we'd have one squadron with a 72% loss of flying personnel, some 20 airplanes completely washed out, and more close friends killed than we can count on our fingers and toes. See the B-17, which we were told was so sturdily built that it could not stand anything, fall apart before our eyes. And there were many more incidents that will be imprinted on our minds forever. I am pleased and honored to welcome 2 guests directly connected to Captain Arthur Allen. And without further ado, I'd like to welcome to the podcast, on behalf of Don Allen, Jeff Copsett, and myself, I'd like to welcome Austin Rich and Frank Allen. Gentlemen, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, Frank, if you would, introduce yourself and tell us how you're connected to Captain Allen.
Okay, thank you. It's such a privilege and an honor to be here. My name is Frank Allen, and I live in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm a retired financial advisor and a part-time film producer. Arthur Allen was my uncle. I never got to meet Arthur, but I saw his medals on the wall and got to know him clandestinely through my dad. My dad was just an incredible record keeper and kept a lot of the articles that were written about Arthur and kept Ramblings of a Bomber Pilot. And I learned about Arthur through my dad.
What was that like? Actually, I wanted to ask you the big event in your family's history and in the story of Arthur, of course, comes down to July 26th. 1943. And if you would, we know that Arthur was getting very close to his 25 missions. And if you would you please walk us up to that day and describe the events of that day, July 26th, and why that's so important?
Yes. July 26th is a very special date and a date that I'll always remember. We actually published or debuted the film on July 26th of 2023 on the 80th anniversary of his last flight. So there's special significance in several ways. But Arthur was a B-17 pilot. He was based at Ruffham in the UK. And That was in Bury St. Edmunds. So he had been on probably around 19 or 20 flights. And he had just been on a flight where he led the entire 94th Bomb Group on a flight on the 25th. And for that mission, which was a flawless mission, no casualties and all the bombs hit the target, he received a Distinguished Flying Cross. The next day, he was appointed to fly to Wilhelmshaven, Germany. So he and his crew and his squad flew on the way to Wilhelmshaven. And when he got there, the bombs, smoke bombs had been put out to obscure the targets. So he was diverted to Bremen. And in Bremen, as he went into Bremen, the fighter aircraft there were ready for him. And so it was a very, very difficult time. And he was actually shot in the cockpit. He was the only casualty, the only wounded in the cockpit. The airplane made it back. The co-pilots flew it back safely, and the rest of the crew was fine. But that was Arthur's last flight. And so I'll always remember that day in history, for Arthur.
I had an opportunity to read several of the documents connected to his last flight, and including remembrances of the co-pilot who was there and some of the other fellows. And it would seem to me that what happened was a bullet pierced the skin of the bomber and shattered his left humerus. And the bullet continued on into his chest and stopped in his heart. And he was immediately killed and slumped forward over the controls. And Rondelez was the co-pilot and was trying to push him off the controls so he could, keep steady flight. There's a lot to unpack in that whole story, which we don't have time for. But needless to say that the crew, his death hit everybody hard, didn't it? I mean, it wasn't just the crew.
Well, it certainly did. As the plane landed, they shot flares to show that there was wounded on board. And so by the time the aircraft stopped, the ambulance was there. It happened to be someone that was a close friend of Arthur that first got out of the ambulance and went into the cockpit and looked at Arthur. And so he went right back to the ambulance and just couldn't really handle it. So there were several people there. His Colonel Moore was there to give him a Distinguished Flying Cross and actually a promotion. He was going to give him his captain's bars, which he had earned from his last flight. And so Colonel Moore was a personal friend of Arthur's as well. So there was, the crew was we interviewed the fella, one of the Ruffham Air Museum control tower. He's the historian there. And he told us he had interviewed a lot of Arthur's crew and that the crew was just really subdued and really taken back and didn't know what to say. They were all silent and in grief. And everybody was because Arthur was a friend to a lot of people. So, yes, but it was a sad day there for them and turned out to be a sad day for us as well.
Jeff, Don, do you guys know what the casualty rate was for the air crews? What was the life expectancy? I saw a figure today that was like 50%.
Are you asking us?
Yeah.
Oh, it depends on what time in the war you're talking about, right? I mean, 42 into 43 was much different than the missions in 44 and 45. I would argue that Captain Allen's time was probably at the height of the casualty because at this time, early on in the war, the targets were coastal France, places like that. They weren't very deep. They're hitting the Atlantic Wall essentially. So missions were shorter, engagement times were shorter, and the aircraft. The German aircraft weren't as developed as they were. So when you're talking targets like Wilhelmshaven and Bremen, Now they're much deeper missions. There's much more aircraft involved. So that there's complications just in rallying these B-17s, right? And Frank, you were there. England weather is not like Florida or Texas, no. Right? So when you're putting up 300-400 B-17s for one mission as opposed to 15 in 1942, accidents happen. So I don't know what the casualty rates were. I couldn't give you a hard statistic, but I would say that July 1943 was about the absolute worst time to be doing what Arthur Allen was doing.
I can give you some generic averages. It basically depends on the type of bomber and the position of the crew. Just some generic numbers here. Lancaster bombers, new recruits' life expectancy was only about 2 weeks. The average life expectancy of a Lancaster was 21 operation shorties. A B-17 bomber in the late 1943, the average life expectancy of a B-17 crew member was 11 missions. The chance of surviving 25 missions was just 25%. Wow. The life expectancy of a tail gunner was only about 6 to 8 weeks. Overall, the average death of bomber crews members was 23. The majority of RAF bomber commander air crews, that was the average age. Let's see, the overall survival rate of an air crew during World War II was about 24%. The remaining air crew were either killed in operations at 51%, killed or wounded in a non-operational accidents, 12%, or became prisoners of war or evaders at 13%.
My goodness. Now, Frank, I think, in Austin, we're definitely going to delve into your connection to this story. But, you know, Frank, reading Arthur's writings again today, I couldn't help but feel that on that interim between the 7th and the 8th mission, that he was starting to come to grips with that fact, which Don and Jeff were just talking about, that his reality of getting home was very nil, very small, and the chance of getting home. And I feel like that's why he wrote what he did. And your family has had many opportunities to discuss the writings. What does your family feel about Arthur's penning those words at that time?
Well, it's just amazing. He was such a good writer, mm-hmm. even before he went. He was a yearbook editor. He wrote letters. He was really good at expressing himself in very unique ways and ways that attracted people and pulled people in. So it did not surprise us that there was something there that came from Arthur that captured his experience. So we were amazed to see it. We weren't really surprised after we read it because we knew that was Arthur. That sounded like him. And he was a very responsible individual. But I really also think, we saw it in some of his writings. One of his letters he had written, "I've gone shopping for clothes to put on for my return trip." He said, "It won't be long." So he was already thinking, okay, if I can make it through a few more missions, I'm close to the end here, and I've already got my clothes. So anyway, it was it's really cool to be able to see what was on his mind, what he was experiencing. He talked about the crew members, so we got a really good idea of his relationship with the crew members. We've met some of the crew member families. It's been amazing. We met the family he was not the tail gunner.
He was bombardier.
He was the bombardier. And he was the one that got Arthur's personal effects and turned them in. He sent them to my dad later, much later after Arthur had passed. So the crew and several of the crew members said, yeah, Al, they called him Al. Al was one of my best friends. So he just had a really good relationship. He knew them. He knew his crew. I've read other books about World War II where the pilots did not have a great relationship with their crew. But that wasn't the case with Arthur. He had an exceptional relationship with his crew and wanted to watch after him. He considered himself their leader and that they were depending upon him. So all of that was evident in his writings.
What was it like growing up in a home where you're a Gold Star home? Where a service member had died during the war. I mean, my family, we have a Gold Star home as well. My My grandmother's dad was killed in World War II in the infantry. He's buried in Belgium. So, it's something that's passed on, and I'm sure that was the same with y'all. But do you have, Frank, do you have like a memory of like when you first became aware that something significant?
Well, see, I wasn't born, when he was over there. So it was, and I didn't, I knew my grandmother and I never met my grandfather, but the way I learned about Arthur was really through my dad. And I'd come into the house and I'd see those medals up on the wall. And then he'd tell me, here's another story that of Arthur's experience. It's in a book, that captures these experiences, the lingering contrails and several other ones. So I didn't really grow up as a kid thinking about Arthur. His name was mentioned several times, but then as I became to be an adult and have my own family, that's when I really began to really appreciate Arthur and miss him and lament the fact that I never met him because he was an athlete, he was active, he was. Played on the football team, the tennis team. He did so many things, and I just, the more I knew about Arthur in my, young adult years, the more I felt like, I realized what I really missed.
I think that from personal experience as well, I think that appreciation of history and when you get older and you start having family of your own, you start realizing the impact of those kind of things. And I think also that I'm just going to guess here, but I would say that probably your love for him actually led you to the person sitting next to you, this amazing fella, Austin Rich. And if you would you please let us tell our listeners, how you guys met and how that friendship started, and then Austin, if you can just kind of then take over and tell us about what you're doing.
Yeah, I'll be happy to. Austin's father and I worked together at Shoemaker Financial as a financial advisor. So I got to know Austin because I went on some broker-dealer trips, some sponsored trips where my performance and his performance were such that we got rewarded with some special trips. And so this fella went on those trips, some of those trips with us. So I got to meet him. That way, he actually interned at Shoemaker as well, so I got to know him there. So I remember one special trip was to Tombstone, one of our favorite trips. But my wife didn't like it, Austin and I loved it. But Austin, after I retired, or actually just before I retired, Austin got married, and so we were at the at his reception, actually. Of his wedding, and I said, "Now, Austin, I really have a story here that I'd love for you to help me tell. I just really feel the Lord nudging me to honor Arthur's life in some way. And every time I pass those medals, which were now in my office after my father passed, they were now in my office. So every day I'd pass them, I'd say, okay, I hear you, Lord, I hear you." So I talked to Austin. He had done a documentary before about on his granddad, who was a beekeeper. And so he was dabbling, kind of, and stepping in with a little toe, I guess, into the film business. And I said, I don't know what this looks like, but would you mind just talking to me sometime about that? What can you do, or can you do anything, or can you direct me to help honor, do something to honor Arthur's life? And his first response was, "Well, let me get married first and go on my honeymoon." I went, "Okay, that's fair." That's fair, but let's talk about it when you got some time. So, sure enough, in November of 21, I guess it was, we sat down, and as soon as I showed him Ramblings of a Bomber Pilot, what Arthur had written, his eyes started gleaming, and he started smiling and said, "Yeah, we can do something with this."
Yeah, as far as for me, as far as when we met, Frank told the story really well. We had some good times in Tucson, but and Tombstone, but yeah, the really beginning for me was video production was about 7 years ago, and started working here in Memphis. And one day, I decided to create a project on my grandfather. He was a Vietnam veteran and a beekeeper, And he's someone I've always looked up to. And just being able to tell his story was an incredible experience. And so I made that film about 3 or 4 years into my video production experience. And it was enough that Frank saw it and a few others saw it and had me create some things for them. And, you know, whenever I sat down and read Ramblings of All Prelate in Frank's office, I couldn't believe that the story hadn't already been told. It was just right there. I could picture all of it, and it was just incredible. And so I told Frank, I said, yeah, I know we can create something, but, you know, give me some time and let's figure out what that is. And so I think we waited a week or two. We met back, and I came with some ideas on, hey, here's how we can do this. And we started from there.
This episode brought to you in part by our friends over at 1791 Everyday Carry. Whether you're looking for a holster to home your favorite multi-tool, regardless if you're working on cars, motorcycles, working on a ranch, in a wood shop, 1791 Everyday Carry tool organizers allow you to carry those bulky tools in a streamlined way. Just because you like to be prepared doesn't mean it has to affect your style. With 1791 Everyday Carry leather products, you can be prepared without looking disheveled. Discover more about the 1791 Everyday Carry products. Simply visit d-410.com/1791.
So what does that look like, Austin, when you guys decide to get together, you're going to decide we're going to do a film? And I mean, I wouldn't even know, like, what does that look like? How do you create, draw, sit down and do an outline together? Do you write back what people you're going to need or what places you're going to need to go to, resources? Like, what does that look like?
So Frank and I talked about it. We figured out sort of from that first meeting, we had talked about, you know, here's kind of what, you know, maybe it's a documentary, a scripted film. And if it was going to be a scripted film, I knew, like, I probably can't do this at this stage that I'm at, but I know at a documentary, I know everything that goes into creating a documentary, having created one before, and even smaller ones, I knew that, you know, I could do this. So for us, we met the second time. Like I said, I came with ideas, and it was basically this vague idea of, hey, we should fly in a B-17. We should go to Europe. We should track down any other thing that we can that is a connection to Arthur, that is a step that he took in his life, just to sort of recreate not only what he went through, but also to sort of give Frank an opportunity to retrace his steps and to be able to experience the places, the things that Arthur did. So that was really the original goal. And you know, Frank and I were talking about it, and he was like, that sounds great. You know, let's figure out exactly what we need to do from here. And from then on, I was doing as much research as I could. Mm-hmm. Several months went into that, just figuring out not just Arthur's story, which I needed to have everything, like every single detail of his life I wanted to understand and to fully grasp before I undertook this fully. And that's was my main goal. And then from there, it was to research the people that knew him to see if anyone was still alive. I remember going through his yearbooks and literally just researching every single person's name, not finding any luck, as it was, you know, 80 plus years ago. So, but ultimately, it was worthwhile because, you know, we continued to do that research, and later on the line that helped me find Cliff Hall, who was the historian in England that we were able to interview. He was alive. He was 12 years old and grew up right beside the base in England, and now he's the historian in England. So also got to interview awesome. Lucky Luckadoo. So being able to track these people down and understand the importance of doing your research beforehand, before you get started on something like this, and also researching B-17s that are still flyable and that would let you fly on them and rent them out and be able to bring cameras on and everything. It wasn't super easy. I had some no's. We're not interested. We don't want to have to deal with that. It's like, okay, no worries. We'll find someone else. So ultimately, we were able to fly on B-17 Texas Raiders. And very sad that later on, I think we were the last flight that they had before their flight in Dallas later that year, 2022, where they crashed in air collision. But yeah, I'm very grateful for everyone on that crew that was able to fly and take us. It was a very special time, very special experience for both of us, every single step of the way.
Documentary. And
your mic cut out. Start over again with your question, your follow-up. Oh, go ahead.
I want to say, Jeff, you got, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah,
Jeff, you got to actually see the documentary as well. And you got to, well, I'll let you go. I'll let you take it. I know Texas Raiders are special to you.
Yeah, gosh, Frank, Austin, listen, I could talk for weeks about a B-17. And the listeners, they know that this has been my thing for my entire life. I think I was about 12 or 13 when I met Captain Robert Morgan, pilot Memphis Belle, at an air show in the mid-90s. And then that was it, right? Like, I'm hooked forever. And I told the guys right before you came on, I just kind of try to do a quick count, you know, estimate. I have about 35 books specifically on B-17s or written by a B-17 crewman. So it's a huge part of my interest in World War II. I can't say enough about that. As for Texas Raiders, you know, we don't want to beat that one too hard. But yeah, I happen to be at that air show when that happens. So we've discussed that several times. And you know, obviously this was not planned. But Austin, you have also done an amazing job keeping the legacy of the Texas Raiders forever. Obviously not planned, of course. Just such a beautiful thing. I watched the documentary once. Dennis shared it with me. It was a thing of beauty. I saw it several months before I got to meet John Luckadoo. So it was like this, oh man, this is going to be awesome. Like, I've seen this guy in an interview. I've seen him in a documentary. And of course, when I met him and I shook his hand and I mentioned that, and of course I'm in my full uniform, 8th Air Force uniform as a bombardier on a B-17. So we had a good old time after we talked about ramblings.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a neat experience. Then I shared it again. So my son was with me at that air show, and his best friend and his best friend's father surprised him with a flight in Texas Raiders that morning. So he got to go up that morning. He was wearing a GoPro, took a picture with the crew, the whole nine yards. It was the last flight where a paid customer was on the aircraft. 2 hours later, it's on the ground. So I had my son invited, you know, his buddy over. We watched Ramblings again and brought tears to the kid's eye, you know, just seeing it again. And I mean, I get it. It's powerful, very powerful. And, you know, I'll have to go here in a little bit and I'll talk all night. And Dennis knows you're going to have to just shut me down with B-17s. But, and as a veteran, as a combat veteran myself, I understand the importance of making sure that, you know, this doesn't get forgotten. And I steer away from statistics for a reason. And, you know, if we say, 2,500, that's an estimate. You don't want to be it was actually 25-1 and you forgot that one. So I shy away from it. But the fact that the 8th Air Force lost more guys killed in action than the entire United States Marine Corps in World War II is a testament to what Arthur did. And it's just as much of a testament that you two guys and others and Frank and your family, Arthur's immortal now. And I remember having conversations with my guys over there. You try to look on the bright side, right? When you first go over, it's never you. I mean, it's the other guy's gonna get, yeah, I'm not gonna get hit. No, not my mama's baby boy. But then as things start happening around you, then your mindset changes to, it might be me, but probably not. And if you're there long enough, and you're like, I, at any given moment, you know, bullets aren't prejudiced. So once you come to that realization, you have to face it. And the conversations that me and my guys would have is, it's better than, you know, dying of cancer painfully, or it's better than a drunk crosses a double yellow line and you don't walk away. Your death becomes meaningful to more than just your family and friends. And the fact that Arthur could not have a more meaningful life and could not have a more meaningful death, it's just so special to know you guys, to be introduced to the story from Dennis. He knew immediately I was going to get hooked on ramblings. I mean, it's such a special thing. But to be immortalized, I don't think Arthur would have asked for anything more. In fact, he probably wouldn't have asked for it. He'd have made sure that everybody remembered everybody in that aircraft with him that day, and
That's
everybody
right.
on his left, right, upper echelon, below him, and everywhere, you know, in between, on that day over Bremen. I truly believe that just from what I know in his writings. So well done to both of you. And I know he's smiling, and he's probably giving you guys a big fat salute.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, and I appreciate you saying that so much. And I want to share one, I want to piggyback on that by saying when we went to Wilhelmshaven and we went into the Naval Air Museum, and you see all these exhibits and they explain what they're showing in the exhibits. And in one of the exhibits, it showed some writings about the German strategy, which was a U-boat, centric strategy. They wanted to build submarines and U-boat, get them out there, get them out in the Atlantic, and kill our troops before they came over. And what they said in this German naval museum was that strategy never got off the ground because of the bomber pilots and the bomber raids. And as soon as I read that, it gave me an additional, significance for Arthur and his peers that they saved the world. I mean, this was a it, what they did was so important to this to knock off the strategy of the Germans, and so our strategy was better than theirs because of people like Arthur and doing exactly what he did. So when I walked out of that museum and I took a picture of that writing, and it just warmed my heart so much more for Arthur, and gave me a much deeper appreciation for what he did and why he did it and how significant it was.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would argue there was no insignificant mission flown in that war. Some maybe more significant than others. And I do want to say this. I found it interesting first coming across the story that Bremen was a secondary target. It's still to me, it's almost like a paradox, because when you're prepping for a mission on the coast at a U-boat facility, and then all of a sudden, your secondary target is Bremen of all places. I mean, Bremen was a hot spot. Bremen was a widowmaker, and it just still to the. I wish I could find more information on this, because I mean, I understand. Obviously, we all know every mission had contingency targets, right? Whether they're socked in, smoke screens, whatever it is, they had to have a contingency target. But gosh, that mission changes in so many ways when that smoke screen obscures Wilhelmshaven to go to Bremen of all places. I mean, I just think about how much more fuel you're expending you didn't think that you had to expend. So that means, did you, what is the bomb load, right? Because the bomb's trying to hit the sub pens under, and you saw it, how many feet thick of concrete. You know, that's a much different bomb than you may be using for a ball bearing factory or something like that in Bremen. So what was the bomb load? Even going to Bremen, what was the actual target, and were they prepared for it? And, you know, it's just, those are the things that kind of go through my mind, for that to be a secondary target. Arthur had to have known, ooh, you know, we drew a short straw today, boys. We better buckle up, because what a ride that's going to be.
Yes. Well, also the fighter escorts played a role in his lifespan. You know, I know when Doolittle came in, I guess the spring of the next year, and said, no, we got to have some fighter escorts here with extended range. And wasn't it the P-51s that were at that time? So that changed the whole air war. You know, and so at the time Arthur was flying a bomber, he was a fighter and a bomber, because he didn't have anybody, you know, watching, you know, going ahead of him and taking out the fighters. He had to take out, he and his peers, you know, had to take out the fighters and then drop the bomb. So that was another thing I learned in this, you know, exercise and going through this and learning a little bit more about what he had to face and what was going on with the war and the strategies involved.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The Mustang completely changed the whole complexion over there, as did General Doolittle coming in under Ira Aker. The tactics were not working, but he didn't have the same resources that Doolittle had. Of course, you know, a lot of times their missions were being escorted by Spitfires, P-47s, sometimes P-38s, but nothing that had the range of the 51. And also the fact that the escorts were allowed to go after targets. That was something that Doolittle, when he first came on board, said, what are these guys doing just flying next to us? What is that doing? And that was the order of the day from Aker. After Doolittle came in and said, no, they're there to kill Germans. They're there to take airplanes out of the sky. I don't care if they're hitting them on the ground on takeoff or 30,000 feet. We're going to take out German airplanes. So that was a whole other complexion that drastically changed going into 1944 for sure. And like I said, guys, I could talk all night about it. But Austin, okay. I mean, I want to congratulate you, Austin. I mean, like I said, just a fabulous documentary. I can watch it over and over. And I know Don and I met on a little film thing. So we've seen some of the ins and outs of how those things work, and thank goodness, because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for that. So I'll turn it over to Don.
Just a friendly reminder, the October Patreon prize giveaway is coming up at the end of the month. If you've yet to register, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on the Patreon link, sign up and subscribe. All you have to do is be a paid active subscriber. At the end of the month, we're going to pick the winner for this month's prize, which is a beautiful prize pack provided by our friends over at 1791 Everyday Carry, valued over $100, containing different items from 1791 Everyday Carry, including multi-tool carriers, flashlight carriers, the items you need to release the bulk from your pocket from the daily items you must carry to complete your job. For more information, head over to d-410.com/1791EDC. Once again, all you have to do to get your name entered into the prize pack giveaway is go to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on the Patreon link, sign up and subscribe. You have to be an active subscriber by the end of the month. Your name will automatically be entered into the prize pack giveaway. So from what I understand from hearing other documentarians, one of the key differences, and I think logistically it has to be a little more lively, and I could see possibly build some anxiety, but make it more interesting and fun, is when you have a movie in and of itself, you have a script, storyboard, things change as you go. But with a documentary, you have an outline, you have a story, but you go to do your first interview, and that interview might provide you stories you never heard of before, or perhaps even contacts you didn't have previous. And now your whole project just changed. You're like, wow, we had A, B, and C. Somebody just gave us an entire new alphabet of contacts and places to go. How did you guys keep the project going when you're constantly getting new and new information fed to you?
So that was a big challenge. I mean, it's a great point to make, because, you know, we have our outline, and the whole idea with filming with Lucky, I knew that I had wanted to film with a not only a World War II veteran, but mainly a bomber pilot. And looking for one, not finding luck, not finding ways to contact them, it was a challenge. But literally getting that name late into the process, as in 3 months before we are going to debut the film. And so getting that name and then reading the book and setting up the interview all the way until we ended up filming on July, in July, like first or second.
July 6th.
July 6th. And the film was set to debut the 26th. So we had to immediately get in, edit that, and find a way that it where it perfectly fit into the film. And that was just that's just a great example of something that, you know, hey, this is a documentary. Sure, we have this set date, and everything's moving along perfectly. And then, wait, there's this awesome opportunity. And how do we get that into this? And so it became a, like, hey, what do you think about this? And Frank was excited, and so we made it happen. And the editing, you know, it took a little while, but we made that happen as well. But yeah, that's just another example of, like you said, you know, you're going along, you have your outline, and it's really just being disciplined to the story. Story is the key. Story is the king, I should say. And you don't want to stray away from that. And ultimately, you might have these different avenues and different things to go down. And you just have to ask yourself, does this fit to what we want to do? Does this fit to honoring Arthur? Does this fit to honoring veterans that not only sacrificed, but also paid the ultimate price of their life? And so that was the key for us, was in each and every single one of those decisions we had to make, was do we do that? And ultimately it came down to one or both of us, and it wasn't always easy, but some of them were.
Well, I want to add to that, because I give you my perspective on that, because when Austin said, we're going to Dallas, we're going to film Lucky, we're going to interview him, I said, well, where are the questions? He went, well, you're going to come up with them. I went, oh, okay. He said, but don't go. Don't get on that airplane unless you've read his book. You have to read his book. I went, okay, all right. So I got in there and I started reading. And on the plane coming down, I'm like, I'm writing my 7 or 8, 10 questions, whatever. And what I thought was, when we went down there, because we were so close to the debut, was, well, we might get a quote. We might get a picture. We might get something, get him holding this book or something, but we're not going to get much. And when I got down there, I mean, we filmed almost 2 hours straight without a stop. I mean, at least. It was just question after question. He was so articulate. He didn't ramble, as you saw in the movie. I mean, but I was thinking when I left there, how are we going to, we got so much to use. And his dad, Austin's dad, was telling me, now don't let Austin make this film more than an hour and a half. You can't do it. And I went, I think we just went past it, because I don't know what we're going to get rid of. There was so much good stuff. We tried to fit it all in.
That was going to be my next question. As someone who does a lot of video editing and audio editing myself, the phrases, you know, leaving the baby on the cutting room floor. And when you have that, so much great content with such a great character, but that character is just supposed to be an additive to this great recipe you have. And then all of a sudden you have this content, this interview that could almost be a project in and of itself. And you have to cut and whittle and cut and whittle. And not only cut and whittle, but you have to do it in a way that it contextually makes sense when you take that 2-hour interview and cut it down to 10, 15 minutes and still get as much of that gold nugget in there. How did you guys labor over that? And how did you make, you know, between the two of you, decide how much time of this project you want to dedicate to that one awesome sit down?
So that was the hardest part. to be honest. I mean, Frank had some things that he said, you know, I really think these two things, I think there was a couple of things that you had said, you know, I think that should be in there. And I agreed wholeheartedly. But, you know, as we went, it was, you know, back to those things that I said earlier, does this serve Arthur's story? And there's a lot of foreshadowing in some of the things he says. He mentions Bremen and how hard it was. And he mentions some different things on different flights that he had, that it almost just alluded like to later on what we would find out what happened to Arthur. And that was my goal for this film. I mean, at no point, you know, could have started off early in the film and tell you what happens to Arthur, and you go along and, you know, knowing already. But I didn't. I ultimately had the audience find out late into the film, near the end. And I think that part, that whole interview, really set up for an experience of, hey, what did Arthur experience? And then ultimately a great foreshadowing of, this is what's going to happen to him. And so, yeah, that, as far as a specific time, I didn't really sit down and say, hey, I have 7 minutes for this. I sat down and said, hey, does this fit or does it not? And sadly, there were things that didn't. Incredible things that he had to share. But like you said, you know, it hurts a part of you. Because it's like, I want this in there. But ultimately, it doesn't serve the story. And so you have to cut it. But ultimately, it was just an incredible experience. And I could not thank Lucky enough. I mean, not only for the interview, but all that he did for our country and just every story that he had, just so unbelievable. So it was just amazing.
Well, and Don, I really truly believe that one of the things that Lucky did for our film was just to bring incredible credibility into our film. Somebody, he was there. He was actually there, and the experience he gave were very vivid, very, so he did a great job. So I would also tell you, when we left, as we were packing up after the interview, I said to Austin, I said, we got so much good stuff here. I said, that's why I'm paying you the big bucks, is to figure out what to use, but not only what to use, but the flow. Mm-hmm. The flow he had, I mean, to me, I was involved in everything that was filmed, but I had no idea how it was going to flow. And I said, that's why I hired you, and that's why I'm paying you, and that's what you got to figure out, is how to best tell this story, because we've got so much good stuff. And that's where I think he really earned his keep, and he did a fantastic job.
You know, real quick, he said something about him adding the credibility to our film. And one of the things that was the coolest to me was they actually flew on one of the same missions. So we were talking about different missions and found out, hey, they went to the same place on the same date. Good chance that was the same. They were in the skies at the same time. So pretty remarkable if you think about it that way.
Wow. Now, we were kind of talking about earlier how creating a documentary leads you down different roads. Let's be honest. Austin, somewhere on a file server, external hard drive, SD card, you have tons, I'm assuming, B-roll. I'm sure you got to the point where Frank was like, why are you constantly shooting B-roll? As an editor, you can never have too much B-roll. Trust me. You can do a lot with B-roll. You didn't get this? Well, we can do voiceover and slap some B-roll in there. But what I want to get to is, let's be honest, you have a ton of B-roll from two different historical figures that, one, we've lost, i.e. the Texas Raider. I'm sure you have a ton of footage that you shot that day that didn't make it into the documentary. And then, you know, the interview that you have with Luck do, that may present itself to you guys 4 years from now in a different project that you never even considered doing because of the amount of B-roll you were lucky enough to have and the amount of time you were lucky enough to sit down and interview him for 2 hours. That's something you guys may be able to help preserve historically in a future project.
Well, and the same thing would apply to our conversation with Cliff Hall. We interviewed him all day long. And so there's a lot of B-roll,
right,
I think, associated with that as well.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I mean, you've got my wheels turning now.
That's what I do.
But yeah, I mean,
that's awesome.
I know that, especially when it comes to the Texas Raiders, it's a really good point because I filmed that plane every inch. The day before we did the flight, we had a day where we just filmed a bunch of footage all over the plane and looking to see what different shots would look like and test shots, and none of that made it in the film. So there's a whole day of tons of content that is just there. So
even if I just had an idea. Even if it's not Texas Raiders specific, you have 8K footage that you can even do just a little virtual tour of what it's like to pass through. Because even in the documentary, you showed a little bit of what it was like to pass through some of those corridors. Beautiful. For those of you listening at home, I watched the documentary. I believe it's on Netflix. It's on a few other places. The videography, the photography, it's a masterpiece, especially when you're up in the air and just going through Texas Raiders and the different areas throughout the plane, the sneak little peek over into the cockpit, seeing it's a beautiful masterwork of videography. And, you know, that's an option too. Now, you guys mentioned Cliff Hall, and I had his name down here. How lucky were you guys to have access to him, and how did he come to your being aware of him? And at what point did somebody say, yeah, so apparently we're going to have an entire luggage full of cameras and microphones because we're going across the pond to do an interview?
Yes, that is a really great story. And one thing, the film is on Roku and Tubi and Netflix. We would love that, but hopefully
Arrowverse.
It's on Arrowverse as well. But yeah, Netflix, piss up. But in all seriousness, as far as the story for Cliff Hall, it's really incredible. So I'm reading Lingering Contrails. It's actually back here, but reading a story about a 12-year-old boy and his experience, and he's got different quotes on different things. And it's in this book, and at the bottom it says Cliff Hall, he was 12 years old and grew up right beside the base. And I was like, man, I've got to find this guy. So I get on my laptop and I'm looking, search Cliff Hall, nothing. And I close the book and I was like, man. And I mentioned